Donald in the Kitchen talks about food. Donald in the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald in the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald in the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Priskintos.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And our kitchen table is conveniently located here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames. Community Radio is supported by us, the community, and Community Radio makes the world go around. So, welcome to our kitchen table. Here at the Donalena Kitchen, we talk about food and farming, and sometimes the Donalena Kitchen takes a road trip to see how things are doing in other places besides central Iowa. Well, Donna is back. Welcome back, Donna.
Thank you. And I have a little suntan to show that I've been somewhere else.
Donna returns after way too long away, but she had a wonderful time.
Just a month.
She's going to give us a food and farming report from New Zealand. So there's lots of things to talk about. We're going to talk about the price of groceries and water quality, rich farmers, a revisit to some of the places she visited before because she has been to New Zealand before. She's going to visit a cider maker and a chocolate factory. Lots to talk about. Welcome back, Donna. So where and why did you go to New Zealand?
Well, the reason I have been there so much is because my daughter and my only grandson live there. So I had not been for a long time when my grandson was little. I used to go every winter, and now it had been 8 years since I had been to New Zealand because it is a long way to travel. It can take up to 24 hours to get all the connecting flights to get from Iowa to New Zealand and back again. So it's beautiful there, of course. And sometimes I feel like the people living in New Zealand who call themselves Kiwis, that means they live in New Zealand as opposed to Australia, right?
It's a different place.
Different place, right. Though New Zealand is two islands kind of near Australia.
Yeah.
But even if, you know, to fly to Australia is a couple of hours. I mean, they are not, you don't just get in your little boat and zip over there. It's a very separate country.
I get out to Atlas every now and then and kind of, I like maps. So I was looking. And compared to Australia, which you think, oh boy, this big lump of a country, New Zealand looks rather small.
It is a small country. The two main islands, as they call them, the North Island and the South Island. Now, of course, you have to remember, you're on the other side of the equator. So the South Island is colder. See, I'm upside down. The South Island is colder than the North Island. Okay. So my daughter lives on the North Island, and the part she lives in is called the Bay of Plenty. What a lovely name. And the climate there is a lot like Southern California, but with more, well, now Southern California is inundated with rain, and normally it's not that wet, but New Zealand is wet and green most of the year round, and it's, you know, no snow except on the mountaintops and that sort of thing. I have this feeling when I'm there, so there are the Maoris who are the original. Well, they've been there for 1,000 years or more. Anyway, they were the ones that were colonialized by the English. And so there are two, the English descendants, and of course there are a lot of South Africans there, and, you know, but the white people, as they say, they're called Pakeha for some reason, P-A-K, blah, 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 Pakeha. And then there's the Maori people. So it's pretty, compared to the U.S., let's say everything is pretty harmonious there. And the New Zealand government has made a lot of repatriation of assets and land to the original inhabitants, then, you know, that they kind of blunderbussed during the colonial conquering, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, there's ongoing things, and they're working on the discrimination, et cetera, et cetera. But I would say it's a smaller country. It's, I think, 8,000 people total.
8,000?
8,000. A million. Sorry. 8 million. Oh, couple zeros there, Donna. Whatever. Anyway, it's not densely populated. It's maybe similar to Iowa's population density. Yeah. But, of course, it's longer and more spread out. And the major population centers are usually on the coast, with the inlands being either a lot of wilderness, beautiful, beautiful, pristine wilderness, especially on the South Island, the South Island, which is the coldest. That's where they have mountains and fjords, and I think they shot a lot of the stunning photography landscapes in Lord of the Rings came from the South Island. So that gives you an idea. Now, New Zealand has a large tourist industry.
Ooh.
Right. So they are very aware that people are coming for their stunning scenery and beautiful environments. And, you know, it's a big deal. Mm. And it's worth it. Mm. You know, so, but that means the government has an incentive to keep the environment more attractive. And that's something that we don't have here. And since they're a smaller country, they can... You know, it's like trying to maneuver a speedboat as opposed to a tanker. Small countries can implement things more quickly often than a bigger country. Sometimes when I'm there, I feel like the people who are living there, especially the ones with British heritage, are kind of, you know, after coming, even if it was their grandparents coming, they've all been back to England, and comparing England, which is another island, to New Zealand, I feel like they have this kind of satisfaction for living in a tropical island in the middle of the South Pacific, right?
And especially if they're consciously trying to not screw it up environmentally.
Yes.
I mean, they should have a little chip on their shoulder then. I think that's a good idea.
Yeah. So I have to say, water quality is a big deal there. Keeping their streams and rivers and managing their, you know, mostly it's a lot of livestock. So you'll see, you know, once your eyes get used to the kinds of greenery that are there, you'll begin to distinguish, okay, these are pastoral fields, okay? You'll see the sheep, you'll see the cattle, broad expanses of, you know, green grass, basically. And then there are large parts of standing pine trees, row after row after row. I mean, it's still green, but logging and growing pine trees is a deal.
Oh, as in row after, planted row after.
And the problem is, of course, once they, I think it's every, I don't know, 35 years or something it takes, I could be a little incorrect, but, you know, those pines grow quickly. And so wherever those forests are planted, every 35 years, they go in and clear cut. And it's pretty ugly when they do that, you know, so... and then the third thing that your eye will see in the landscape is what they're calling the bush, which is, it's often Maori territories, because the Maori, like lots of indigenous people around the world, are really big on preserving their heritage and the nature the way it has grown for thousands and thousands of years. So that bush that is inhabited or controlled, and it's not all Maori, you know, some of it could be public lands too, but the bush is gorgeous. They have all kinds of, you know, ferns, and I mean, we're talking, you know, big things. It's not like palm trees or something, but the bushes are not what our eye is used to seeing here. Huh. They're dense. Now, New Zealand has no snakes.
Oh,
unlike Australia, right?
Ooh.
But they, you know, they have some pest problems too, but the bush is just full of, it's gorgeous. I've never seen anything like it. So those are the kinds of landscapes that you'll see, and your eye will be. Now, one thing I did notice this time, there's more corn growing there.
Oh.
Like Iowa. Not the scale of Iowa, to be sure, but lots of big fields. And what they're using this corn for is to feed dairy cattle.
Oh, yeah. The last time you were there, we figured out was 8 years ago. So mm-hmm. if you notice more corn. Huh?
Every time I go, I notice more corn. And since they had an 8 year absence, visually it was more arresting. And part of me, when I see those big cornfields, I go, oh, I know where this is going. You know, it would break my heart if New Zealand started being just like Iowa. However, there is a big difference. New Zealand does not allow genetically modified seed agriculture.
Oh, this is the whole country.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So that corn that I'm seeing in New Zealand is not GMO, which means they are not spraying, you know, randomly the herbicides and the pesticides. They probably have other ways of managing it, but it's would be significantly, I would say there would be a big difference in the amount of, it's not that they don't use pesticides and herbicides, they do in New mm-hmm. Zealand, especially it's a large fruit growing area. Like everybody knows New Zealand wines, they're really quite good. Of course, kiwi fruit, avocados, they export a lot of fruit and wine. And they export a lot of beef, a lot of lamb, a lot of wool, and a lot of milk and dairy.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, you wouldn't think that milk would come from one small, small island in the middle or south.
It's very weird. Once I went to a museum dairy. In New Zealand, and it had a thing that was used to carry huge blocks of butter from New Zealand to England, 100 years ago. They had some way to preserve it. Now, obviously, they must have added salt to the butter. But butter for England was coming from New Zealand, you know, even 100 years ago.
Oh, my goodness.
So they have a long history of dairying in New Zealand. However, I did run into, on the beach one day, I found a man fishing, and he, you know, they're very friendly there. Oh, hello, hello, hello. And what am I doing? I'm visiting, and on and on and on. And he said, oh, he was a retired farmer. So I said, what is all this corn for? He said, okay, so, I'm guessing he was like 75 or something. He said, I used to be a dairy farmer. And that this corn is for feeding cows, he said. Then he went on, unprompted by me, and said, he said to me, when I was a dairy farmer, I kept the size of my herd to equal what I could grow on my farm. I mean, they have a lot of pasture anyway. Mm-hmm. So growing this corn is because they're putting more cows on an area and they have to supplement feed, right? To produce. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's what this farmer just told me. And I went, oh, right. Okay. So I'm saying this is probably a change in the last 20 or something mm-hmm. years. Now, here's the thing to know about the New Zealand dairy industry. Roughly, and I'm just guessing because it's only in my memory banks. I did not look it up. Let's say 15 to 20 years ago, or maybe only 15. I don't know. In the fairly recent past, the major, largest dairy company in New Zealand was sold to the Chinese. Ha! Huh. Does that sound familiar? Do I remember talking about how the Chinese bought Smithfield, one of the largest pork producers in the U.S., sometimes before the pandemic? So, you know, that means for both New Zealand and for Iowa, or Smithfield has a lot in the Carolinas too, but for the U.S. and New Zealand, we are producing food that is being sent to China, and we are pushing it or being we are producing in ways where the environmental cost is accrued in our country, both New Zealand and the U.S. and wherever these things are happening. Right. So, for example, in Iowa to raise pork, and in any place in this country where Smithfield is raising pork, you know, the U.S. environment suffers the consequences of the effluent from the confinement feeding operations. Mm-hmm. Only one part of it. In Iowa, for example, the corn grown to feed the pigs and other things, right, we have the environmental consequences of that, which is degradation of our water, our soil, you know, all to feed the Chinese people. Not that Chinese people should go hungry or anything like that, but, you know, this is global business. It's, it used to be, you know, and I'm sure America has done this a lot. We go to third world countries and do nasty mining things, for example, to benefit our country. You know, this is the way of the world, but we need to be aware of these things. So in New Zealand, they are growing more corn and doing more dairying. Now, of course, the Chinese didn't buy all of the dairy, but the largest one, which was a significant. Now, I have to put a little aside in here while I'm meandering on this topic. Let's just say this. Dairy is not a traditional part of the Chinese diet. And, you know, that probably means lactose intolerance is even in this country, it's very widely spread among any population that is not of Northern European descent. They really don't digest the sugars, the lactose sugars that are in milk. So my guess is the Chinese demand for milk, you know, I've been to China. You don't see cheese in the farmers markets. You know, they just don't eat that. Probably the biggest demand is for infant formula. This is a guess. I have not read any research on this. Well, because, like, remember the U.S. in the last couple of years, we had infant formula scandals because the largest factory producing infant formula in this country had some highly pathogenic bacterial thing. And so we had a national shortage of infant formula. And I think President Biden had to fly in airplanes full of, because, you know, children, babies need it. You know, if you're not breastfeeding, you have to have infant formula. So the Chinese had a similar problem with some adulteration was being put into the formulas. It was some kind of white plasticky something that I think proved fatal for a few infants before they caught it. So there has been a thing going on in the Chinese culture where they didn't trust the Chinese baby formula producers, and they were using a lot of imported formula. So my guess is that a lot of that milk is going, you know, for infant formula in China, but don't know. Anyway, so, funny thing about, you know, this was years ago, you're driving around in the country. I love to see everything agriculture, and you're seeing dairy cattle everywhere, huge pastures, it's all beautiful, blah, blah, blah. And then it dawned on me, there are no barns.
Huh, no little red barns?
No any color barns, no big sheds. No, I'm thinking, and it took me a while, I went, duh, and I realized they all have outdoor milking parlors. And the cows don't need shelter from the weather. It's not cold there. So you don't see barns, you know. You do now see large rolls of, I don't know whether it's alfalfa hay or silage or baleage or whatever, but you do see those rolled up in the field just like you do here. And more of it because there's a lot more animals on pasture. There are no, to my knowledge, animal confinement feeding operations, certainly in the beef, dairy, and sheep industry. They just don't do it.
Well, let's go back. Now, you talked about dairy. Let's go back to water quality as how it affects all these animals.
Yeah, they're not all right. It's an issue. Okay. I don't remember how many. It must have been at least 10 years ago at the Practical Farmers of Iowa conference. Could have been more than that, even, maybe 12 years ago, there was a couple from New Zealand, some beef cattle farmers, Mike and Sharon Barton, and they came to present at the Practical Farmers of Iowa conference. They were actually talking what happened because New Zealand stopped giving subsidies to their farmers. Farmers do not get any kind of subsidy in New Zealand.
Ooh.
Market prices. And export market price is the same as domestic price. So somebody living in New Zealand has to pay the same amount that some exporter would pay to, you know, buy the product and ship it overseas. So Mike and Sharon came and they talked to PFI about how that worked and how everybody adjusted. And they also talked about a project that they were involved in. So in New Zealand, a water system, which means, you know, a river, its tributaries, whatever, is called a catchment, as in the water is caught in these systems. And then, of course, it goes right to the ocean, right? So their New Zealand water catchment was, they live up by a lake called Lake Taupo, which is, I think it might be called the cleanest, clearest, deepest lake on the planet.
Oh my.
It's a volcanic origin. So the soil around them is volcanic, which means it drains very quickly. So in their catchment, they were doing the research, the first ever in New Zealand. And this was, as I said, 10, 12 years ago. So in their fields where they were doing rotational grazing with their beef cattle, the government sent in some scientists and they planted in the ground all these little pieces of equipment that would register how quickly the pee or nitrogen from the cow would go through the soil and what amount of nitrogen went directly, you know, into, was going to hit the water system and not be retained by the soil, which is different soil than we have. But anyway, they put these pieces of equipment in all over and monitor them over a period of time to determine how many cattle per, well, they do it in hectare, which is, you know, it's a measurement like acres. But anyway, the stocking density for the soil type, how much it could take before the cows were contributing to the nitrate pollution in Lake Taupo. Okay, so this was a research experiment run by the government, paid for by the government, and from that they wrote laws.
Laws.
Imagine this. It is not a suggestion. It is a requirement. How many cows you can have given your the type of soil and your location. So the Taupo catchment, which was where Mike and Sharon lived, was the first to get this ruling. So, of course, the farmers are like, you can't limit my ability to make money and na-na-na-na-na-na-na. But, yes, they did. So what Mike and Sharon did is they, for their own farm, decided that they would brand their beef and sell it as an environmental, you know, okay, you're a tourist visiting a lovely high-end restaurant in their region. Would you pay more to have a piece of beef that adhered to these principles and kept this area pristine and beautiful? And they found out, yes, this works. So they set up a processing beef selling company that would, and they enlisted other farmers so that they could all get a slightly premium price for their beef to offset the losses of not being able to grow more cattle.
Ha. Well,
and it worked.
It sounds like New Zealand is serious about water quality, at least in animal agriculture. It's nice to see they went in and found out or something and they did
something. Yeah, it was based on science. Hello.
Well, that's good.
You know, not just some arbitrary financial, you know. So as a consequence, like I just read today, which lake was it? One of the Great Lakes has been declared one of these tourist rating industries has been declared a place that you don't want to go because it's so contaminated and so full of algae not worth being a tourist.
Great Lake.
One
here?
Of our Great
our
Lakes.
Great Lakes.
Because we have been putting so much nitrogen in the water through, and this is an Iowa story big time, Iowa being one of the largest contributors to the nitrogen in the Mississippi that makes the Gulf dead zone, right? But now, it's not Erie. It's not Superior. I only glanced at the headline this morning.
But still, we are talking to Donna Prisgintis, back from a visit to New Zealand and finding out about food and farming, because that's, of course, the first thing I ask her. So how did things look there, and what did you have to eat? And we'll be back with more Donna. This is the KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Donna Lana Kitchen. Donna has just got all kinds of things to talk about the food systems in New Zealand. She's back from a trip, and well, one thing you mentioned there, food is expensive, gas is expensive. Mm-hmm. There's lots of small businesses, and people refer to rich farmers, and you mentioned there's no subsidies. What is going on?
I know. This one always gets me, but every time I go, especially non-farming people always say, they don't just say farmers, they say rich farmers. It happens so often, and every time I just about trip. It's like concept doesn't go into my brain. I'm thinking, what do they mean? Rich farmers, right? Instead of poor struggling farmers. But for example, we went to this beautiful beach town, and there are lots of rather extravagant, New Zealand houses are generally smaller than American houses. Huh? But you go to this beach town, and here are all these big, new, beautiful, expensive houses right on the beach. And you can see half of them are empty, and people will say, oh, farmers buy these houses for their vacation homes. And then you go, well, I guess the farmers must be rich. You know, it's just, I have a hard time wrapping my head around it. And so, okay, this is pure speculation on my part, having been there multiple times. I have not done the research on it. I don't know that there's any research. There might be. But since New Zealand farmers do not get paid subsidies, okay, that most of the farmers in this country couldn't function. They would go out of business mm-hmm. without government subsidies, mm-hmm. you know. So lots of farmers here, just because the way the system is, are actually forced to grow products to meet the needs of subsidies, because that's their income source. Especially because there's a lot of price fluctuation, and this has been going on, golly, since the Dust Bowl, right? So New Zealand, as we said earlier, eliminated subsidies a good more than 10 years ago, right? So how are these farmers getting so rich? My only possible guess is that the mid-level of processing and distribution chain is so much shorter that a lot of the food dollars, like an American farmer of a product that you buy at the grocery store, less than 12% of that will go back to the actual farmer that grew the food, whatever mm-hmm. it was, whether it was corn for a highly processed food or a tomato, right? Mm-hmm. So the food dollar percentage going to the farmer in the U.S. is very low. My only guess could be that farmers in New Zealand, because their infrastructure and processing of their food system is much, much smaller, that they must get a higher return of that percentage of the food dollar. And I would guess a significantly higher return. So I will, delve into that further. But it was the most astonishing concept for me of the whole trip was the rich farmer concept.
Well, they're selling a product people need.
It means people can make a living being farmers.
And people,
What a good idea.
And they're evidently used to paying money for food.
Yes. Yes. And gasoline. Gasoline was, I mean, even though it's sold in liter, it was equivalently to about $8 a gallon. Mm-hmm. That's a lot. I mean, it's a small country, but you still drive around. Mm-hmm. And milk. Of course, I was buying the, you know, top of the line organic milk, but that's what I buy here. And I would say it was not quite double the amount, close, but not quite, because mm-hmm. liters are a little bit different from quarts. You know, you make all that translation, but you know, if the half gallon that I buy of the top of the line Kelowna is what, five or something, you would get a liter for that price. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's more expensive, but everybody pays it.
There you go.
There you go.
Oh, and you visited a small farm that had a lot of direct marketing, and you found raw milk there.
I did. It was really cute. It's a little farm. They grow vegetables, and they have enough dairy cattle. I think he said 18. That's not a huge herd, but they sell everything directly off their farm. So like, okay, now the other funny thing, especially about the area, which is Tauranga, a lot of cruise ships come in there. So I have a friend. So part of the business for tourism locally is when those people come in for their, you know, 24 hour or stop or however long it is, thousands of people get off of these ships. These are gigantic. And they all pick tours that they want to go on. Some of them go to see the Hobbiton set. Some of them go to Rotorua to experience all the geothermal hot springs. There are a lot of things that tourists can see and do in New Zealand. And my friend Catherine Chappell does food tours. So she gets a busload of people that want to do a food tour, and they have, you know, I don't know, 5 or 6 hours that they drive around in the area. She shows them how the kiwi fruit is grown. She takes them to see bees and honey. These are products that are produced a lot around, and she takes them to an avocado farm, and then she takes them to this small dairy farm, and it's adorable. Of course, they have the baby sheep and the baby lambs, and you know, you can buy the produce right out of the garden. But the milk, they have a milk house with a vending machine. So you can, you know, drop your, they have $2 and $5 coins there. You drop your coins in, you can get a glass bottle that is dispensed and ready to go. Then you put some more coins into the milk, or you can bring your own bottle if you're a local person, right? Then you put the bottle in this thing, drop your coins in, and then the spout opens up and puts the milk right into the bottle. There you go. So it's, you know, the farmer doesn't have to be, they're selling it to you. It's all automated. And it was raw milk. And it was delicious.
So there you go.
Yeah.
Well, another small business that you visited had something to do with chocolate.
Well, this was the delightful thing. Maybe it's because it's an island, but there are still a lot of locally owned small businesses, and people make a decent living, enough to pay for very expensive gas and very expensive food, right? So a family can make a decent living with their own small business. So this was a small dairy farm, you know, and they're, you know, like an avocado orchard could be as small as 20 acres, and they can, you know, and then the businesses around town. Yeah, they have giant Kmarts and some shopping malls, but not the way we do here. It does not dominate the commerce scene. There are lots of independent, all kinds of, you know, food, clothing, restaurants, really stable business climate for, you know, the way the U.S. was before we franchised everything, like when Lana and I were growing up as children. My parents were in small business operators of office supplies and equipment, and they sold because Staples was coming to Galesburg, Illinois, right? Boom, time to get out. So that is not so much the case in New Zealand. You can still have a reasonable lifestyle, a very middle class, comfortable, beautiful, way of living and have your own small business. So one of the businesses that I visited was a chocolate factory.
Oh, how nice that.
Oh, yeah. It was fun. So I'm thinking chocolate factory because Catherine says she takes her food tours to the chocolate factory too, right? So she takes me to, the company is called Solomon's Gold because the chocolate beans are grown completely fair traded, single source origin in the Solomon Islands.
And the first thing I figured was, how far is the Solomon Islands and from New Zealand? And where the heck is the Solomon Islands?
Oh, I had to look it up, too.
Okay.
It's part of the sort of, it's a little north of Australia, north and east of Australia. Yep. There in the...
It's kind of part of the bunch of islands.
Yeah, it's near Vanuatu,
Papua New Guinea.
Yeah, right.
And so I looked at, so they are at 6 degrees south of the... Of the equator. So chocolate.
Well, but coffee and chocolate are grown in the same climate and some places actually interplant them because they're good together. Ah. So the Solomon Islands, this company, Solomon's Gold, has kind of, gone in to support the cocoa business was kind of dying out and they've gone in and helped the farmers to up their production, the quality of their production, make sure they're sustainable. And keep growing this chocolate, which they then send the beans. Okay, so cacao plants are, it's a fruit. So it comes in a big pod, like the size of a mango, more or less. They say they're completely sustainable. So I don't know exactly what they're doing in the Solomon Islands with the fruit from their coffee plants. But other places are actually turning that into, because it's pretty vitamin rich, turning it into a useful product. Chocolate beans are dried and processed in the Solomon Islands. So, well, only processed in that they are dried and separated from the fruit. And then it's shipped in bags, just like coffee bags, the big burlap bags, then it's shipped to New Zealand. Anyway, in the chocolate factory, you know, when I'm going to visit, I'm thinking, oh, Charlie in the chocolate factory in this big cavernous building. No, it's two large rooms, you know, high ceilings, and the rooms are maybe 20 to 30 feet by squared, and this contains everything they need to make it. So, first, the beans come in and they're put through something that looks, it looks like a fanning mill, actually. It's a large thing that shakes them through screens and sorts them by size and quality, you know. So they're picking out the good beans from the beans that are broken or shriveled or whatever. So first they have to sort the beans. Then they have another machine that grinds the beans. I think they have to roast them first. So there's a roaster. It's a lot like a coffee roaster. But then the process changes. They grind it into a paste. And there's, you know, there's cocoa oils and things in these nuts. So somehow they have a machine that grinds it into a paste. And then there's another process. It's called tempering where you... I'm going to try this sometime. If I were a confectionery pastry chef, I would know this, but chocolate beans have to be that melted, shiny thing that we get in our bars. The beans have to be cooked to a certain temperature, then drop down to another temperature, and then you can melt them and use them the way you want.
Oh, really? Okay.
So we will be experimenting with that because I did bring home, aside from some beautiful finished chocolate bars, which you tasted, what did you think?
They're pretty yummy, yes.
They're pretty good, yeah. I also bought a big bag of cocoa nibs for baking and another bag of the chocolate before it's been tempered. So we're going to play with that a little bit,
oh,
Lana.
Oh, really?
Well, we might make a mess out of it. But,
I can't think of a more. I bet the place smelled pretty darn good.
Oh, it was heavenly.
Oh,
heavenly,
good.
Heavenly.
Oh, good. And here I have a note to ask you about. On a past show, you went across the news item about, believe it or not, there might be some danger in chocolate. So pass that on.
Yeah, well, other than the fact that you could make yourself overweight by eating too much chocolate, the recent studies have found that dark chocolate or chocolate has high concentrations of cadmium and lead, both of which are not healthy in large amounts. So we had talked about that I'm going to just quote the New York Times article. It says, do I need to avoid dark chocolate now? Well, their conclusion is that we do need to be mindful of it, because figuring out which, now they're not sure yet, although this is being explored, where the source of the lead and the cadmium are coming from. And it could be, these are naturally occurring elements in the soil, so it could be in the soil, or it could be coming from environmental pollutions or something or other. So the Consumer Reports first published this with the whole list of, you know, and this includes organic chocolate. This is not something that you can read on the label. There is a website. Where is it that you can look up that goes by? It's talking about the safe intake levels of chocolate. Now I'm not fine. The New York Times recommends, continue to enjoy your dark chocolate in moderation, because of course the higher the percentage of cocoa, which has more antioxidants and is better for you, it also means the higher levels of lead and cadmium. So it does say they don't recommend it for pregnant or breastfeeding women, because lead particularly affects infant brain development, and not to feed it to children, young children. We'll keep eating it a little bit. And I'm not seeing the website where it says, shoot. Well, maybe you can find it at Consumer Reports. They do go through the brand names and say which ones have more and which ones have less.
Well, good. We'll just do that. Thanks for the heads up on chocolate and what? Oh, chocolate. What a nice thing to visit. You're listening to KHOI and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more about this radio station and this fine Donna Lana Kitchen program at www.khoifm.org. Donna Lana Kitchen. Oh, Donna, you found that website?
Right, in the New York Times thing about chocolate. And we don't want to scare you out of eating chocolate. It has not stopped me. There is a website called As You Sow. That's S-O-W. As You, S-O-W. And on that website, they do have list of cadmium and lead levels in a lot of products that we're all familiar with in the supermarkets here. It's a pretty extensive list, but, you know, if you want to rattle your brain a little bit, go and look up your favorite chocolate brand and see what it says about it. Some are more egregious than others, and we still don't know why, but it is something that the chocolate industry and the confectioners are actually stepping up to research this and figure out what the problem is. So,
good.
There we go.
Well, Donna is giving us a food and farm report from New Zealand, and she mentioned how there's a lot of wonderful small businesses, and they're kind of working to keep their environment sort of okay, and things are good there, and lots of sunshine, and you went to another interesting, actually, you revisited a place when you were in New Zealand you visited.
Maybe 10 years ago, I took my little iPad, which has a recording device, and we went to this just charming cider making. It was two young people with their little children and family business. You know, they had an orchard and they were making cider, and it was really good cider. So we went there to visit them, and we had a little recording session somewhere in our archives. So I went back again with my friend Catherine, and they now have a restaurant there. Okay. Get this, and this is not uncommon in New Zealand. The restaurant is open from 11 a.m. to, I think, 3:30 in the afternoon. It's a lunchtime restaurant, 5 days a week, and it's in a beautiful outdoor setting. And, of course, they serve all their ciders. Now, at this point, I brought the cider menu home with me. I think there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 18 kinds of cider. And they've won a lot of awards for their cider. These are the ones I tried. I tried the hop cider, which has that kind of hoppy beer. It was delicious. They have one they called a mojito cider. Was really, he's obviously having fun doing this. And then they have a red kiwi fruit cider. They have something called the Frenchie, which is a French style, full bodied, medium sweet. I found it very good and frankly better than most of the French ciders that I had drunk in Brittany. It was good. It was really, really good. And if you buy what we call the flight here, which was four little sampling sizes, it's called a paddle.
See,
here we go.
It's got to be something different, just so you know you're in a new place.
Yeah, so that lovely family business has grown a great deal, and the kids have grown, you know, they're all like 11 or 12 now. It was delightful.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Oh, good. So, you didn't mention the ocean. You were kind of close to does one swim in the ocean there?
Oh, yes. Ooh. The ocean there it's the other side of the Pacific Ocean that I mean, from living in LA, I'm used to swimming in the ocean there. And it has waves. There's some surfing. Some days it's wilder than others. And it's clean and it's everywhere. There is water everywhere. There's lakes, there's oceans, there's river. And people swim in all of them, anywhere.
Very good.
Which, coming from Iowa, is, let's call it refreshing, okay?
I know you love to swim. How nice to go to a place that you can do that. Yeah. Oh, and also, you sent me some pictures over the internet, so I could kind of, as I'm sitting here in January, bemoaning our gray winter, you sent me some pictures of some redwoods.
This is the funniest story. So one of the main geothermal centers in New Zealand is a town called Rotorua, which is famous for its hot springs, its hot mud baths, its lakes. It really has some stunning things going on. So a young friend of mine, Huya, took me. He grew up in Rotorua, so he gave me a couple of tours of Rotorua, and he took me to a very large redwood forest. I'm thinking,
what?
Are redwoods indigenous? He said, no. About 100 years ago, a little more, at the turn of last century, some American who was living in New Zealand decided that she would bring in some redwoods. And apparently the redwoods grow twice as fast there as they do in California because of the richness of the volcanic soil. Plus there's maybe more moisture, but there is a large, I mean, like, I don't even know how many hectares, maybe, I don't know, at least 500 or a big redwood forest growing in Rotorua, and it has become a beautiful park with a lot of walking trails, and they have put one of the world's best bicycling so they have, you know, world class trail biking through that forest.
Ah,
it's just gorgeous.
Well, I You sound like you had a real good time, Don.
You know, I think people in New Zealand, on average, look quite healthy.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like a beautiful place to live. And what's nice is it's nice to see, to hear about different ways of raising food and growing community and
For me, the takeaway is because it is a smaller country, they are doing things, you know, that we haven't been able to do here because they don't have the large corporate lobbying groups don't have the same amount of leverage there. So it can be done. In certain places on the planet, they are doing some of these things, and we can take note of how it's worked and perhaps copy some of that here.
Oh, good. Well, thanks for all the good news from New Zealand. I'm glad you're back in Iowa, but I'm glad you had a good time in New Zealand. Oh, good. And while we're talking about, you spent your time in sun and warm southern winter is their summer, and things are getting warmer here. I want to mention a little spring thing here. Every year about this time, my husband and I tap a maple tree. We used to do a lot of maple syrup, but this isn't necessarily for maple syrup. It's really nice to tap a maple tree and just get maple sap.
Well, it's like it's maple water.
It's maple
water. It looks like water.
And it is really, really good. Now, remember, to make maple sap, you have to boil this water down. Maple sap is about 5% sugar and about 95% water. So if you drink it right out of the tree, it's sweet water. And
it tastes like maple syrup.
Yeah, yeah.
It looks like water.
Yeah.
And it must have some nutrient content.
Well,
what do you think?
Just think of what all those trees are doing this time of year.
It's amazing. It's like water from the tree.
It is. Well, yeah, it's water from the tree. And actually, Native Americans and, well, probably lots of other people too, it was a wonderful spring tonic just to tap a tree, just to get a little bit of that good sweetness. I looked up what exactly is in all of this stuff because if the trees are pumping all of this stuff around, they must have things going on in there. It contains potassium and calcium is most of it, with substantial amounts of magnesium and manganese and trace amounts of some other stuff.
And no lead and no cadmium.
Well,
oh,
no,
my goodness.
No.
Yeah.
No calcium, not cadmium, no.
Yeah.
But it's got all kinds of things.
So it's your spring tonic.
It is spring tonic.
It's like having water filtered through the tree. Amazing.
Isn't that a lovely thing? What trees do for us, it's a very, very good thing. And it's not really hard to do. You put a tap in the tree. We use rubber hose to take it down into a bucket, or you could find an old fashioned.
Well, so a tap is just a little.
It's a hole.
It's a hole.
Yeah,
with a little spout on it or something.
Yep.
And you
just
hammer it into the tree.
Right, and then usually on the south side of a tree to kind of encourage the summer spring run. But then be sure to take it out, especially when the trees start to bud. They need all that sap, and it will heal itself. It's maple sap. It's a good thing to think about this time of year. Yes, it is. Well, I want to think about some upcoming things here. It's a good time to think about seedlings this time of year. Not necessarily to plant a lot of things yet, but trying to figure out where things are. And I want to mention the upcoming event. There is a Central Iowa Barn Dance happening this Saturday, February 24th, right here in Ames. You can find out more at the Facebook Central Iowa Barn Dance Association. And besides the Barn Owl Band, there will be a concert by a band named Urala, which is a wonderful thing. Right? We usually have a halftime. There's going to be a special halftime concert. That's good. That's good. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We come to you at noon on Tuesdays, repeated 7 p.m. at this fine radio station. We had music by the Barn Owl Band. Support this fine radio station. My name is Lana Natigo.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
With Fine Engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.